At that time, Jesus said, I praise you, Father, Lord of heaven and earth, because you have hidden these things from the wise and learned and revealed them to little children. Yes, Father, for this is what you were pleased to do. All things have been committed to me by my Father. No one knows the Son except the Father, and no one knows the Father except the Son. Sorry, and those to whom the Son chooses to reveal him. Come to me, all you who are weary and burdened, and I will give you rest. Take my yoke upon you and learn from me, for I am gentle and humble in heart, and you will find rest for your souls. For my yoke is easy and my burden is light.
Thank you, Tracy. So now we're going to have a bit of a different sort of structure for our talk. We've got John and David coming together, so I'll give them their stage.
Everyone, we'll meet Dave in a sec. He's the guy with the headphone on and the white t-shirt, maybe waving.
Hello.
Before we get to that, there's probably just a few caveats I want to go through just to get some guidelines around what we're doing today. So I just want to be really clear. This Dave is a registered psychologist, but this isn't medical or psychological advice. We're discussing theology and how theology and psychology meet on this idea of depression and anxiety. I might put Trace on the spot now. I've just messaged you some phone numbers, Trace, which I forgot to add in earlier. But if you could replace the final slide that we have, which normally has the BSB, just with those phone numbers that I put on for you, that would be awesome. While Trace is doing that, there's a few numbers that I just want to bring to your attention to use to call for help if we need, or if you guys need, or if I need, whoever. So there's Lifeline, there's Suicide Callback Service, and there's Beyond Blue. And the numbers for those services will be put up at the end of the service. And in terms of finding support for depression and anxiety, probably your GP is the first step to go to in terms of being referred to a local psychologist. But other forms of support you can find would be kind of pastoral care through your pastor, which would be me, or other people that you know, such as like friends and family or members of the congregation, people that you feel you can talk to about these sorts of things. Depression and anxiety kind of is a whole person sort of thing. And we'll be touching on how it affects different parts of your life. And depending on what you might need help with, or what you feel like you might need to talk about, you might approach different people. So you might approach your GP or your psychologist or a friend or a family member for different reasons. And we'll get into that in the interview a bit today as well. But sometimes clinical support is needed. So therapists, counselors, psychologists are trained to do work with some of the more painful and complex stuff as well. So those are just a few caveats. Turn to those people if you need that type of support. And there's no shame in doing that. Even as a Christian, there's definitely no shame in asking for that type of support. But this isn't personal support for you. We're not giving medical or psychological advice here. What we are trying to do is to try and normalize the idea that Christians encounter depression and anxiety. And encounter negative emotions that we've just been going through in the past 4 weeks. We want our church and the church as a whole to be a place and a people that you can go to and talk about deep issues. There's no such thing as a perfect Christian. We all struggle with different things in different ways. And that's part of the normalization process that we're hoping to go through. We want to talk about these things so that you know that they happen to everyone. Lament, sadness, grief, desire for vengeance, anger, all those sorts of things. And today, depression and anxiety. What we're trying to say is that they can all be enacted in a godly way. That doesn't mean that they're all automatically godly. There's definitely ungodly ways you can enact those emotions. But it is possible to be a Christian and experience those things and yet still be godly. So the idea of today's interview is that David will mostly be providing a psychological perspective on the matter of depression and anxiety, and I'll mostly be providing a theological perspective. Dave himself is also a Christian, so he'll throw in his thoughts about theology and faith as well as he goes. But what we hope is that at the end of the interview, between the two of us interacting with you guys, is that we'll take the first steps towards thinking about how to live as a Christian, particularly with depression and anxiety, but also in a practical way. So throughout the interview, feel free to throw your questions up on the Zoom chat or the Padlet chat. We'll address them as we go. Nelson's going to help me keep an eye on it because I kind of lose track of stuff when I get into something. So Padlet for anonymous questions, Zoom for if you're happy to have your name there. But before we start all that, I think it's important that I give a biblical framework for what we're thinking about, which is the idea of that passage that we just read, Matthew 11. So it might not be immediately apparent how that passage connects to depression and anxiety, but let me explain how I think it connects. The passage we read comes just after Jesus denounces the cities that he's performed miracles in, because he's given all these miracles to them, he's shown them all these miracles, but the cities still reject him. But in verse 25, we see that this is the way God's chosen to reveal himself. He's hidden these things, that Jesus is the Messiah, from the wise people, the people in that city, and he's revealed them to little children. And I think we can understand little children as basically to stand for the lowly people, the unlearned group of people. And within that group, looking at the rest of the gospel, I think we can include broken people, people that are weighed down by the burdens of the world, possibly people that are wrestling with depression and anxiety. And it's to these people that God chooses to reveal himself. So Jesus shows us his heart in verse 28 onwards. When we look at his innermost being, when you boil down who he is, it's surprising but really comforting, I think, that Jesus describes his own heart with these two words. I don't think he describes his own heart anywhere else in the Bible. Definitely not in the New Testament, I think. He uses these two words, gentle and humble. And maybe another word for humble there might be lowly. So to those, to all the people that are willing to come to him, for all his power and authority, he's not harsh and he's not easily angered. He's gentle. And to the people that are willing to come to him, for all his glory and his majesty, he's not proud and he's not cold and he's not inaccessible. He's humble or he's lowly. And so when we take his yoke, and the yoke is like the beam that was put across an animal's back for them to like bear the burden of farm work. When we take his yoke, we find it's easy and it's light. It's still a yoke. The call to follow Jesus has requirements, but it's not like the yoke that the world puts on you, or maybe even like the yoke that you put on yourself. It's gentle and humble, like Jesus himself is gentle and humble. So when we talk about depression and anxiety for the next 20 or 30 minutes, I think it's important to have that framework of Jesus, especially calling people like us that have been a bit beaten or broken down to follow him, who is gentle and humble, like a gentle and humble shepherd. That gives us a kind burden that we can bear with that is much lighter than the burden of the world. So let me pray and then we'll get into this interview. Father, we thank you that your son is the good shepherd, that when we get to see into his heart, we see that he's gentle and he's humble, and that he calls us to follow from a heavy burden to one that's light and to one that's kind. So we thank you for this good message in times that might be really hard for some of us. Help us to turn to you, Lord, to continue to follow you and to see that your burden, your yoke that you put on us is gentle, is humble, is easy, and is kind, just like your son. We thank you for this, Lord, and help us to wrestle well with the idea of depression and anxiety over the next few minutes. Amen. So we've got Dave joining us today. Hi, Dave.
Hello.
Tell us a bit about yourself. Just give us a few interesting things.
Sure. I guess it's always good to kind of talk about get the core of who I am, and I guess it helps to tell people that faith is incredibly important to me, and so I'm a Christian. And I guess in many ways, I was very much blessed to come from a Christian home where both like my mom and my dad, both his parents raised me to follow Christ. And so I guess really my identity in Christianity really informs what I do. So Sundays I typically go to church. I go to a church that you might have heard of in Westmead called Hebron Chinese Alliance Church.
Yeah. I've had a few of your ministers actually preach for us recently, which is
wonderful. Yeah, and on weekdays, I guess I work as a psychologist where I try to support people through some very personal and difficult periods in their life, things like anxiety and, of course, depression.
Mm.
Yeah.
So you mentioned you're a psychologist. What's a day in the life of a psychologist look like?
It really varies. I guess typically you'll be seeing a various amount of clients with different presenting issues. So typically for me, I'll see people with chronic pain if they've had an injury, especially at work. You might even see somebody who's been in a car accident who's quite traumatized, PTSD. But you'll also see people with things like, as we're talking about today, anxiety and depression, even grief. But I guess typically a day for me, at least as a Christian, starts with prayer. For me, it helps me set my mind in, I suppose, the right place, really reminds me of my faith and really helps me kind of balance that sort of, I guess, that emotional toll when you deal with, you know, very difficult emotions throughout the day. And really, I find that it's the faith that helps me sometimes balance everything out. But a typical day is, I guess, generally speaking, seeing between 5 to 6, up to 7 people. Individually and sometimes back to back.
Yeah, it must be like a pretty heavy burden, I guess, to have to interact with people on such a deep level for like such extended periods of time. Question about your faith. That was like the first thing that you brought up when we asked about you. Has that been a benefit to you in your practice, like with this big emotional burden, or does it sometimes clash with how you work as a psychologist? What's how do those two interact?
It's quite, I guess, difficult to answer that question in a straightforward way. I mean, in many ways, you know, in terms of handling the emotions and the I guess the way that we deal with people's concerns is we can often find ourselves feeling quite isolated. And so as a Christian in particular, as I said, I start my day often with prayer and really trying to help me understand, I mean, how I even get myself ready. But in a sense, down the core of our profession is really trying to be non-judgmental. And I find that's actually quite a biblical approach as well. And where the benefits perhaps most obvious is if somebody were to say to me, you know, David, and I'll say to them, how are you coping with this? And they'll say, sometimes, you know, my faith is actually the only thing that's kind of keeping me going. Having that background and that awareness helps me lead into that. But it can clash, I guess. You know, we've got to know our own biases, you know, and our convictions. One example would possibly be where marriage is falling apart and, you know, there's such a strong conviction with two individuals about walking away. And kind of like knowing exactly where and when to support someone, but to remain, you know, really clear in terms of where the Bible and psychology meet. So it can help, and it can sometimes mean that we have to be aware of, I guess, where we're personally convicted as well.
Yeah, right. So sometimes you might support someone through an action that your own faith disagrees with or something.
Yeah, sometimes that is, I guess, a point of conflict, I guess, that you wrestle with. In many ways, I suppose, if you take, for example, a Christian that presents and says, you know what, I want out, then it's quite helpful to talk about what the biblical view is, you know, especially if they bring it forward. But I suppose for me, as I understand it, is if they don't prescribe to that or adhere to that faith, you know, they really are going off, you know, something that we can't impose on them in terms of their faith. We can, of course, look, and often we do help people to kind of try marriage counseling as an idea first, not to just give it up. But yeah, certainly it's one of those delicate situations where you have to kind of take more of a duty of care for that individual as well, especially not to impose your beliefs.
Thanks for telling us a bit about yourself.
Sure.
So we've got maybe 20, 25 minutes to work through a massive issue, so depression and anxiety. Clearly we won't make that much progress in, but hopefully we can lay some foundations that we might at some other time pick up again and continue to flesh out from the perspective of both theology or faith and psychology. So we'll just lay some groundwork for the first few questions. How can you tell us how prevalent mental health issues are, I guess, in Australia maybe specifically, or if around the world, if you know that?
Sure. I guess Australia first, perhaps. Look, Australia, I guess it's different because COVID-19, I guess, at least in the impact of the bushfires earlier in the year, have created a more increased relevance of psychology and psychological help. But generally speaking, something like 45% of Australians will experience some form of mental health condition in their life. In terms of depression, typically about a million adults will have it. And in terms of anxiety, it's something like 2 million. So it's pretty significant, actually.
Yeah, so that's kind of like 10% at any given time, is that?
Something Australia's like about that.
25? Yeah, that's huge. That's massive.
We once said to people, at least with depression, for example, if you look around the room and there's 5 people, one of you will at least at some point have it. So 1 in 5 often is a good way to look at it.
Yeah, okay. And just to kind of clarify definitions, can you tell us a bit about the difference between depression and anxiety?
Sure. I often use an analogy, actually, which is quite helpful. Kind of like a tiger in the room analogy. I might throw in stress as well, because it's often misunderstood with anxiety. So I often tell people, look, just imagine you've got a tiger literally in your room right next to you. And let's suppose that I took that tiger away. Well, all of a sudden, you probably wouldn't feel as stressed. And so stress is kind of like this idea where we can actually recognize there's a trigger or something that's provoking a reaction. If you take it away, likelihood is you're not stressed. Anxiety, I guess, is more of a physiological reaction. So you might actually find that you notice things like physiological symptoms like panic attacks, hot and cold flushes. You might notice a racing heart. And that's even if we were to take that tiger out of the room. You might even feel a sense of excessive worry, obsessive or preoccupied thinking. But typically what comes out of anxiety is this sense of trying to avoid a problem. And depression on the other side is actually a little bit more general, in that it'd be like me leaving the tiger in the room and not telling you when I'm going to take it out. You kind of feel a sense of hopelessness. So it's quite different, I guess, with that idea of depression, that sometimes we can feel low, we can feel quite moody, and that's actually okay. But some people experience these feelings of low mood and sadness for more of an intense and long period of time, sometimes weeks and months. So, you know, both of these are relevant in today. But of course, as you were saying before, you know, they can be specific to a particular area where someone's maybe lost somebody or lost a job, or anxiety might be something like you've got a presentation on and something like this today, and I might just be quite anxious about it.
So when you mentioned the depression part, you mentioned it's kind of like a prolonged thing. So I guess I would say at various points in my life I've been like depressed. But like is there kind of a line where it's just like a feeling of depression as opposed to like a thing that you should check out or approach someone for help with?
There are some really clear markers for why you might feel depressed, you know, and really obvious things. So like depending on, I guess, where an individual's at, you can probably tell if you're not just feeling low and sad, because that period is actually goes on for more than a few days. You might notice it's probably something like 2 weeks. And if you've got these symptoms that are kind of going on for a while, you might also notice sort of subjective feelings of sadness. You might feel helpless, but you might also notice that you're crying a little bit more, or that you've completely lost your interest in things that you'd otherwise enjoy. So one of my clients, for example, loved basketball, and all of a sudden, in a period where things were difficult, it didn't matter if, you know, somebody was going to meet him at the court, he just wouldn't go. You can notice things like insomnia, even weight gain and weight loss. So those are pretty good indications that sometimes what you're going through is actually a little bit more than just feeling a bit sad. But yeah, so typically more than 2 weeks, and typically with other things going on as well.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So it's not like a black and white line, but it's like a time is one factor, and then like maybe intensity of emotion is the other factor. Okay.
Intensity, and almost like for a lot of people, there are those, I guess, additional feelings, sometimes shame and feeling guilty can come into it. And so it can kind of make it even bigger. And kind of depending on how we look at the individual as a whole, there's all these reasons why that can actually help to explain why someone's depression, for example, is a little bit more complex than just feeling sad.
Right. Yeah, it's interesting you bring up that point of shame, because sometimes like our Christian faith can bring shame on us because we've got depression or anxiety. Like we think we need to be the perfect Christian, or we think like as a Christian we shouldn't doubt or whatever. But I think that's not the case at all theologically, and it sounds like you're saying that's not the case psychologically either. There's like nothing.
Yeah, it's actually entirely normal. I think if you've lost your job, and take for example something that's happened to a lot of people recently, losing your job in many ways will bring a sense of sadness. Even if you can keep on like a jobs keeper or seeker, whatever they're entitled to, you can really feel quite lost. And sometimes our job as psychologists is first to normalize. For example, if you've lost your job, maybe you don't feel as confident, or your self-esteem's been damaged. And we would say, actually, that's okay. We would expect you to. In fact, if you were laughing and kind of like in no sort of sense seriousness, then we would actually be more worried for you then than if you weren't upset, if that makes sense.
Yeah, definitely. And I guess what we've been going through in the past few weeks in our series on neglected emotions is that sometimes the right response to the situation we're in this fallen world are those types of feelings, lament, grief, anger, seeking justice. Like they can be the right emotion at different times. Kind of backtracking a bit, you mentioned something about I can't remember the words you used, but like the broad view of how depression and anxiety can affect a person. I think we've got a diagram trace to bring up. I think it's the three concentric circles, if you can find it. Do you want to kind of walk us through that kind of model of looking at?
Sure. So this is actually a really helpful model. In some ways, we call it the biopsychosocial model. So you can kind of see there's three spheres there. And I guess as a psychologist, we actually work within frameworks and try and take more of a holistic, I guess, framework or view of that person. So each person or patient that we see has their own thoughts, has their own feelings, and even personal history. So the development of, say, mental health actually is more of an interaction of, say, your biological history, for example, your genetic vulnerability, maybe it's your physical health or the comorbidity of those things. But we also recognize that psychological factors are important, right? So individually speaking, you've got your own sort of attitude and temperament and way of coping with situations. But equally important, and perhaps feeding into the church, is the sort of social and environmental factors around you. So, you know, your culture, potentially as a, as a Chinese Australian, your community group, perhaps as a Christian, And even your socioeconomic class and even family circumstances, they all feed into what we would call mental health. And it's important to recognize that that mental health doesn't necessarily mean bad mental health. Mm. But for a person to actually have, say, take a genetic predisposition for depression, that individual likely would have to have social factors such as extreme stress at work, or maybe some family problem, as well as potentially some psychological tendencies like being perfectionistic, to kind of trigger that genetic disposition for depression. So you can kind of see it's quite complex, but we use these sort of spheres to kind of help us understand how it's not just necessarily one thing. It's actually quite complex. It actually relates to a few things.
And so it kind of, if I'm hearing you right, like one kind of being predisposed to depression, anxiety in one sphere is often not alone what's going to trigger depression, anxiety, but it's kind of the combining of these three spheres.
It can be, yeah. So it can be something like the fact that, you know, we might have, say, and I'm just making one example, let's say, for example, someone's physical health is challenged. Someone's been injured at work, and they all of a sudden they might find themselves feeling quite low. But if you take a broader perspective, it could also reflect that, you know, part of that means that they can't, if they've lost mobility, they can't go to church as easily. Maybe they can't, you know, attend the sports group or things that they love to do. And all of a sudden the way they cope is impacted. And so you can kind of see how it's not just simply taking one thing and being like, oh, that's the problem. It's actually a multitude of props areas to consider.
And I guess then, as Christians trying to seek to deal with depression and anxiety, I can see like church kind of fits in that social aspect of it. I guess theologically would say God is sovereign over all these things. Like he's in control of our biology, our psychology, social environments. But in a practical sense, then church would fit into that, the church community, I guess, would fit into that social sphere.
And so too would your psychological way of looking at the importance and relative and potentially importance of church and what that means for you. So the fact that we talk about sovereignty and the fact that, you know, we believe, you know, God overall has a say, runs the universe, and that we can also have a say in how that works through prayer is actually really important, because it helps us understand as individuals kind of how do we have good mental health. So yeah, it's definitely kind of an overlap of everything in a way.
We'll probably at the end of the interview, we'll get into some more practical ways that we could possibly deal with some of these things.
Sure.
Kind of moving on, why do you think there is this taboo around the area of mental health? Like we talk in media and stuff, it comes up all the time now. In TV shows, you see people dealing with depression. We try and talk about it at church. Like why do you think there's still this taboo around it?
Well, not even just at church, generally speaking. I think it's something like 65% of people with genuine mental illness concerns actually don't access treatment. It's precisely for that reason, because they often think that it reflects something that's necessarily wrong with them. So some of my own clients will tell me, you know, please tell me that I'm not, you know, that I'm not a nutter. Or they'll say to me, I'm taking my nutty pills. That's one of my, my longstanding clients. Or they'll call themselves wacky. It does come with a negative sort of a connotation, because in some ways from the age of 18, typically we're taught to be completely independent of our parents, often, you know, outside of school and now forging ahead. And we often, I guess, in a mistaken way, we'll assume that our lifestyle and our aspirations are going to go up in a linear way, but they don't. We actually can find ourselves falling back or having difficulties. So it's likely a taboo, but it's also more of an inward challenge as well for us to see. But mental health isn't actually just so obvious as what we would call a mental illness. It's actually potentially looking at personal mental well-being as well. And that's often a forgotten thing in when we talk about mental health.
Mm. I guess that's a good cue for us to go to the topic of positive mental health, which I think, Trace, there's the slide before this one might be that slide.
Yeah,
that one.
That's the one.
So do you want to kind of tell us a bit about the concept of positive mental health and kind of...
Sure. So I guess just looking at the orange and the red one columns here, we can often kind of look at ourselves as when we talk about mental health, probably why there is a bit of a taboo is it's so easy to kind of look really clearly at the sort of disruption to our lives as, you know, the problems of it. For example, we would say, you know, if you're depressed or if you've had, you know, perhaps at least some thoughts of self-harm, that, well, that's the obvious stuff when we talk about mental health. But when we talk about mental health in general, we forget sometimes to talk about sort of how we can go from necessarily suffering, which would be these orange and reds, to more of a thriving sort of way. And so if we had to thrive and we consider our actual mental health in a positive way, we would look at it as things that we can do to maximize potentially our health. That can be, for example, you know, really doing things like exercise, and it's simple stuff, but you know, doing things like exercise, going out with friends, attending church, these things actually work to improve our mental health from necessarily zero to being effectively quite a positive thing on you.
Mm. And just noticing under mild disruption, it says common and reversible distress. So is that to say that to some extent moving between different parts of, like, it's not a normal life to always be fully in that green, like you'd kind of
correct
move between them?
I mean, look, the idea is that actually, and normal is not necessarily the best word here. Mm. I guess in some ways it might be more maximized, but yeah, look, it's actually quite normal to have difficult times and to have those emotions. And we talk about sort of self-righting behaviors in the sense that, you know, when we are feeling down, we firstly need to recognize, I guess, what happens to ourselves and kind of lean in on that friend or talk to that pastor or go to that growth group or Bible group.
Yeah.
But just by doing simple things like that, we actually can reverse the distress.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That kind of touches on the question that's come through on Padlet. Mm-hmm. So back to the three circles thing. I feel like we've answered this, but I just want to make sure the person gets a really clear answer. Mm-hmm. With the three circles, if someone is negatively affected in one circle, mm-hmm. is it possible for a positive experience in the other two to make up for the negatively affected one?
So
if someone has poor physical health but has good environmental, social, psychological support, is it possible for that person to remain well? And I guess by well, we're probably talking in the yellows and greens.
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's exactly it. Sometimes, and this isn't, and please don't go around and self-diagnosing or anything like that, but like say someone with some, you know, physical illness, an injured worker, for example, that I often deal with, will present fundamentally with, like, you know, sometimes as bad as a broken back. And you're right, things that really do reduce the amount of impact on their mental health is actually the fact that they do have really good family circumstances, that they really do have a strong sense of, you know, a good attitude, you know, to getting better. And so that intersection actually says mental health, not mental illness. And that's the point, is that we actually kind of assume that this is all about diagnosing a mental illness. It's actually about going, sometimes your mental health can be impacted if one of these things go, but we can be certainly managed better if we have some of these things. And so, for example, the psychological aspect of that blue circle, you might actually have a really good attitude to getting better. You might actually have some really good perceptions about the fact that, you know, you're in a recovery process and that you're, you know, getting help as opposed to going, my life's completely over. So yeah, it's a good question.
Mm. So it's, those three circles, Tracy, if we can go back to it, is that that's more of a picture of, I guess, resilience then? Is that the idea? So if you build up these three things, you'll be quite resilient to
potentially. Yeah. So like in some ways, for example, it's not as simple as that, but certainly these things account for your mental health. It's a good way to look at it. Resilience is, if you take the, just the psychological aspect, that blue circle of resilience, there's often three words that I use with my clients that they can use, and you can feel free to write them down if you like. One is just to consider the personal nature of the problem. For example, is what's happening to you personal? Has somebody actually done this against you? Or is it universal? Is this something that everybody would deal with or has to have struggles with? The second P is, how pervasive is that problem? You know, how much does that bleed into your home life as opposed to just work or even church? And the third one is, how permanent is the problem? So just by kind of putting things in perspective, that's kind of the resilience idea here. But that resilience kind of fits more in that blue circle. But you're right in that all of these things contribute potentially to someone's mental health. And so, you know, let's just talk obvious. At some point, someone's going to probably break a bone or their physical health will be impacted. Well, it's this diagram is effectively saying, well, you can have a secondary psychological concerns just because of your physical health. Or let's say, for example, school isn't going so well and you might feel that you're being bullied or you're not making friendships as fast. Well, that's going to affect your mental health potentially. But just by doing and having some perspective, even some resilience, you can actually, in a self-righting way, manage that sort of mental health. So they're all important, I suppose.
Another question that's come through, which is a good segue, I think, to another thought that we wanted to touch on. Is what are your tips on bringing up mental health issues in everyday conversation, especially for a few of us who have grown up in Chinese Timorese families where these kinds of conversations aren't really brought up or seen as a sign of weakness?
Sure.
I think that kind of just touches on the general question of like, what have you seen, what sort of things have you seen causing people to avoid addressing mental health? So like in this asker's question, it's the Chinese Timorese culture. Yeah,
that's sure. Weak. Okay.
And how can we overcome it? Okay.
That's a hard question to answer. I'll be straightforward there. It's really difficult because even if you just consider the fact that of all the places that we would feel the least judged or hope to feel the least judged, the family unit is often the biggest one. You know, and for a lot of people, mental health, or at least mental health issues, actually represent more so a indication that things aren't right, that you're not actually independent. And so it can be more distressing sometimes to a parent or a loved one to just hear that, to think, oh my goodness, you're not coping, but we've given you everything. We've sent you to coaching. We've sent you, you've got to university. Shouldn't you be doing well? Well, it's tough. But to address the issues, I suppose, is to really talk about mental health more broadly. So knowing what good mental health looks like and what makes you actually thrive, shall we say, is a good way. So rather than just bringing up reactively, so for example, you lose your job or, you know, you don't feel a sense of belongingness at the church anymore, rather than just simply bring that up in a reactive way, like, oh my goodness, I'm quite sad right now. It does kind of actually make it a thing to talk about when things are bad. But when you go on holiday, for example, and you're walking down a beach hand in hand with, you know, your friends or your loved ones, you know, I mean, that in itself is a good point to say, isn't this a really good way to keep fresh and you know, and to normalize it. But one last thought, I guess, is if they are Christians, it's a good point to kind of go to the Bible and consider just even how Jesus, when he was going to the cross, actually wept and sweated tears of blood. It just tells us how real emotions are. So these aren't actually necessarily bad, but they, your social family at least, or family represent a good part of how you cope.
Yeah. The Bible, I think, really normalizes those sorts of feelings in the Christian life. Like if you look at the Beatitudes in Matthew, it'll say things like, blessed are those who mourn. And the kind of I take the Beatitudes as a picture into the life of the kingdom of God, right? If you're part of the kingdom of God, this is what people in the kingdom look like. And some of it is blessed are those who mourn. But the kind of positive side of it is for they will be comforted. So it's not that we are, as Christians, are kind of hidden from all these things, but that it's part of life, but the comfort is also there for us. So maybe as a very light answer to this person's question, if the family's Christian, as you were saying, you could turn them to different parts of the Bible, the Beatitudes or Jesus weeping as he approaches the cross. And our more general answer, to summarize what you were saying, I think, you could try and bring it up in a positive sense. So not that I'm really sad that because of these things, or I'm depressed because of these things, but these things, X, Y, Z, would be really helpful for me. These things would help me. I think, like Chinese Timorese families, like I think where they're not super in touch with emotions, the three circles for the Chinese Timorese family would be like really small. It's just like, education and money and, they'd have a smaller three circles. But I think the heart of Chinese Timorese parents is to like love their kids with everything they have. So if you say, if you bring it up in a positive sense, it might be a bit easier to broach those topics.
Correct. It's hard because, I mean, I guess even in my personal experience, I come from, like I said before, I come from a family where both parents are Christian and my mum was a midwife. And so for her, she would know how difficult sadness is to deal with. But I found also just being very direct and being and saying, I'm feeling really sad right now. And even saying what you need. I had a client once tell me that they would have like a little thing that they would do sometimes non-verbal, like, they'd touch their ear or their nose, and they would simply like be a really subtle way to tell their mom without necessarily that saying it out loud, but going, I just need a hug, and mom would know. And, it's the little things that you do, but you kind of normalize it through time. So it's not as simple as that sort of like, let's start doing this. It's actually kind of normalizing the conversation of mental health and destigmatizing it. So, you're also not trying to put on them the burden of your concerns, but asking them to be part of sort of the comfort that they can do. Sometimes it's just their presence and love.
Yeah. So like not overwhelming them by saying, this is affecting me, I need you to fix it. But it's like, I just need you to be with me while I'm struggling through this or something. And I guess on that note, you might be talking to your parents while you are mentally healthy and not kind of waiting to the point where you're mentally unhealthy and you need something right now, but
correct,
being prepared for that in advance. Okay. So we might, I can't believe we're running out of time. Like that's gone really quickly for me. But we might try and touch on a few like practical ways to live with depression and anxiety, either yourself or with a loved one or a family member. So maybe, do you have any tips on walking beside someone, as we were just saying, beyond kind of asking them, like the Are You Okay Day thing, I think is great. Like it's kind of getting it out there, but what can you do that's a bit more than that?
I guess it's not a straightforward answer because it's difficult. I often find that even just that Are You Okay statement is often a point where you open up a can of worms. And so, we'll often say to people, if you do ask that, that's great, but do make sure you have the time to sit with that person. So, by just saying, are you okay, and giving them a few minutes is sometimes not enough. Practical tip can be to follow up with somebody, especially as a Christian. You might say, look, I'm just going to pray for you. But then to in a way, take that sort of importance of social sphere to then reach out to that person and say, I'm letting I'm praying, whatever the outcomes are, we trust God. But for a person suffering with their own anxieties and depression, realistically, it can depend. So a good way to look at it actually is, I'm going to put something in the chat real quick, just some basic maths. I'm hoping this comes out. If I ask everyone, and I do this actually in my training with groups of people, I'll say, what do you notice with math? Oh, no, I've just sent that just to Michelle. Sorry. Let me send it to everyone. Here we go. That's to everyone. I'll say to people, have a look at this maths. It's actually really straightforward. What's the first thing you notice? Are there patterns that you notice? You know, do you think you see things that are, you know, pretty easy? Like, for example, that it's just maths, it's additive maths. So, what do you notice, John?
I guess 3 + 3 = 7.
What's the wrong with that? It's wrong, isn't it?
It's wrong, yeah.
Yeah. So one of the things that we'll say to people is, if you've not fallen for that, so to speak, but if you see that really clearly, it's an illustration of how much sometimes one bad thing in the day can be the biggest thing in your in the day and the week. And the reason why that's the case sometimes is because we attribute things to that. Mm-hmm. So as a psychologist, we'll often help people to understand the connection between how they think and their emotions. Because what sometimes stops people from going to church is this thought that goes in their mind, which is, I'm guilty, or, you know, I'm not perfect enough, or I've sinned. And behind the reason why they're not attending sometimes is how they're making sense of a problem, or potentially the fact that they're looking at one particular thing and not taking some perspective. So it's an interesting exercise, but that's where sometimes having that professional help comes in, where we can really help someone to either reframe or have a look at something with a bit more clarity and perspective.
Kind of on that topic of, you just mentioned it in passing, of like not going to church while you're depressed. I think my perspective on that is that I really want that to be okay. Like, there's some times where, like, you just can't turn up to church. Like, you're in a deep dip, and kind of turning up to church is really hard. You've lost motivation, you don't see the point. And I kind of taking into consideration that you were saying one of the social aspects of it is having that community, and that's really helpful. Are there times to kind of just, like, I don't know what I'm trying to say. Are there times to escape a bit and just be in isolation? Like,
yeah, I think you've got to be honest with yourself. Like, I'll tell you, last week was one of those weeks for me. Just to put in some normal terms, I was on fire for God for like the whole of probably quite a while, and then all of a sudden I felt quite sad. And I realized actually that part of my heart was closing off, almost like, I just, you know, it's not the right time. I'm just not going to go. In fact, because it's Zoom, my wife actually was watching it, and I kind of, she could see me sitting there not listening, as recent as last week. And it is actually okay, I think, to sometimes take a day off, but to recognize that, you know, sometimes it's more about the timing. And so there might be a time later where, you know, later in the week, for me, there was a pivot somewhere where I just, I got a hug from my wife. We prayed about it. And all of a sudden, you know, I, you know, went for a walk and I prayed and kind of reconnected. So I think, to me, it's, as long as it's not a pattern, is probably a good way to put it. You know, a pattern of kind of every week you're not coming, or every second week or third week. It is okay sometimes to have those days, but I think rather than that you can replace something. So for example, it could just be, if you're not going to church for one day, you might go for a walk and pray, or you might just listen to some music that's worship music. But it's when it gets into a pattern, and when it becomes, ongoing, that we would be a little bit more concerned for you. But yeah, you're right. You're going to have those days. And even if you think about, you know, Peter in the Bible, where he literally rejected, you know, who Christ was, there's a deep sadness. And so your convictions actually at the back of it, are actually really helpful in that they help you get right with God. And and so, yeah, your emotions go up and down.
Yeah.
And that's actually very normal.
Yeah. And I guess the amazing thing about having a gentle and lowly savior, as we saw at the end of the Gospel of John in our series that we just finished up, that Jesus actually embraces those failures of Peter. Like he doesn't ignore them. It doesn't tell him to fix it up, but he just like embraces those failures, knowing that they're there in him.
And there's nothing that God can't forgive. I think that's a massive one, I guess, for me as a male and as a person who actually does have, I would say I do have anxiety and fleeting depression here and there. But, you know, to know that there is nothing that God doesn't forgive, you know, and so to know that you can come back and that you do have these lows and these highs, but knowing that God is compassionate, that he's done and dealt with those temptations himself. And one of the things I guess I try to remind myself as well is very much that we are imitators of Christ and not made perfect yet.
Yeah.
So sometimes if you think about the thoughts that go through our mind is sort of like a perfectionistic walk with God. Yeah. And so it's more helpful to think about ourselves as imitators. But be real with it when it's tough.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah. And I guess a reflection on that I was thinking about as I was preparing for Revelation a bit later on, at the start of Revelation, Jesus writes these letters to seven churches. I can't remember which one it is exactly. I was just flicking through, trying to find it, but I can't.
Sure.
But I think the response of faith at different times in life is different. Because to one church, he says, you're going through a whole bunch of stuff. And you're doing well just to hang on, like your expression of faith there isn't like turning up to church, evangelizing everyone, blah, blah, blah. It's just like hanging on, even by like a thread. And that's your expression of faith at that time. So it might not always be right to head to church and force yourself there. But considering that other things might be a good expression of faith as well.
And at the same time, part of the support a congregation can be in many ways is to actually reach out. Not as a, why weren't you here, but let us know if you need a talk, you know, kind of like an open-ended question as opposed to an accusation. But, you know, those are little things that are really helpful that I think can support someone walking in something difficult. But we would expect people to behave in, you know, certain ways purely because of their emotions. So that's actually okay.
Yeah. Man, I don't think we got through talking about everything we wanted to talk through.
That's okay.
But that was kind of almost expected for such a big topic. So what we might do now is just like wrap up the interview kind of abruptly because we're so over time. But we're going to play a final song now with Nell, and then if any final questions trickle through, we'll answer them. But otherwise, I might come back to you at that time and just give you the last word after that.
Thank you. So I'll just throw it again back to John and Dave for some final words. I think two questions on Padlet came through, so I don't know how you guys want to tackle that, but yeah.
I saw those and I can see that they're pressing questions, so we do want to kind of deal with them. But at the same time, I'm aware that we're over time for normal church finishing time, so I won't take any offense. I'm sure Dave won't take any offense if people need to head off now. But I think it's worth dealing with these two questions. And if you feel like sticking around, please do. One question, Dave, that's popped through during the song. Oh, great song choice, by the way, Brendan. I love that song in general, but good for today's topic. What do you do when your non-Christian friends are coming to you and are coming to say that their marriage isn't working and might head to divorce, and you don't want them to go down that path? So I guess it's similar to what you experience in practice, Dave, where like you believe one thing but the other doesn't. What should be said that doesn't sound judgmental?
Oh dear. Thank you for the question. I guess it's whoever it is, it's deeply personal to sit with somebody that is expressing those kind of thoughts. It's hard to, I guess, in many ways, look past what you want to say to somebody. I guess, because in some ways, by sharing that belief or your faith, that to work on their relationship is actually coming from a good place, you know, from your faith. But in some ways, it's not as black and white, because you often want to share and say, look, you know, we look at marriages as something that's important. We look at marriages as a vow that there is a sort of union that is supposed to be, at least on earth, till death. And I'm not trying to give a quick answer, because I don't think it's as easy as that. But to sit with somebody and let them to express themselves is often the first step. If they want your opinion, they'll I imagine would invite it. You know, and so often when people are talking to you, they're often asking you to just, you know, confirm that they want to, that divorce is the right option. In many ways, you can ask them perhaps more simple things, like, you know, if something were to kind of get the relationship on back track, what would it look like? So you're not jumping around sort of like you shouldn't be divorcing, but you'd be saying, what would you need to see for that relationship to be working? What's the evidence? Would you see your partner coming to marriage counseling? Would you see some positive changes? Would he be listening or she listening? But you're not actually imparting necessarily your personal view, but you're trying to unfold sort of the positive aspect of what that would look like. Because often, I suppose, when someone's venting to you, they're telling you every reason under the sun why divorce is essential. But that's just one idea. But of course, if they do ask you what your view is, I think to frame it as a Christian is always helpful. So to say, as a Christian, our view of marriage is this. And that's not putting them offside, but that's putting it in the Bible and kind of pointing to that as opposed to yourself. Yeah.
And I guess kind of acknowledging that they have a different set of beliefs. So I guess as a Christian, we can't call non-Christians to Christian action.
Correct.
We can call Christians to Christian action, but not non-Christians to Christian action. So I guess like kind of acknowledging as well that they're, you know, this is what I believe. I know it's not what you believe, but.
Exactly. Yeah. It would be just as like, you know, be just as difficult to explain to somebody who doesn't believe that they need to pray every day. I mean, it's not going to necessarily go down in there. They're not going to sit with that and go, okay.
Okay. So general advice, ask questions more than tell them what you're thinking. So maybe you can ask questions along that path, but
yeah.
Okay. Hopefully that's a start to whoever's asked that question. Second question that's come through. How do you help your friend and your friend's kid that is going through bullying at school? Especially, you can see it, that it's affecting them. See that it's affecting them mentally and possibly physically and socially at many times. So how can you kind of, they see this person in pain, I think, and the child in pain, how can they step in or how can they support in that situation?
Goodness me, another curve one. Look, that is, again, such a sensitive matter. And, you know, when you see somebody hurting, you know, we're very good at kind of like throwing up the solutions and what we would do. Usually in psychology, the conversation and the difference between a friendship conversation and a psychological one is actually we rarely tell people what to do. In that we don't necessarily say this is what I would do or this is what I've done with my kid, because typically what they're dealing with is such a unique set of circumstances for whatever reason that child is being bullied. But practically speaking, again, thinking about the solutions as opposed to the problems, you know, you can sit with a person for an hour and just talk about every problem under the sun so that they become what we call they'll know their problems so well. Or you could talk to somebody and say, look, it seems like you're really struggling to figure out a way to find, you know, a step forward or even to kind of orientate yourself in the right direction. Let's just sit down and talk about what we can do practically as well. So some people that I know who have children that are being bullied will start talking about how they'll get their school involved, how they will be, you know, thinking about how to manage the expectations that they have when they're away, and even for the child who's suffering as well. what support they will need. So it's more complex than that, but to sit with somebody and just to acknowledge that they're actually suffering is a good start, and normalizing that. And then to kind of discuss with them, you know, in their own time, you know, what can we do about it? You know, right now, do you need to just pray? You know, and letting them tell you and guide that conversation is often a good start.
So kind of sitting first with the sad truth that we're in a pretty rubbish world at times where kids get bullied and come home crying and hurt. And sitting there with them and letting them ask for the help, as opposed to trying to put a solution forward to them before they're ready.
Straight out, like as in for straight for saying, oh, this is what you're going to do, here's my three PowerPoints on what the next steps look like. You're actually trying to let somebody express sometimes their own hurt, and not to rob them of that, like, oh, don't be silly, but to validate sometimes their emotions, because it can often feel quite powerless, you know. And what we're trying to do is help someone express their fullness. But equally so is the importance of allowing someone, once they've got through that, to work out, you know, what are they wanting to really, like, get out? Like, are they just wanting you to just sit with them? Are they just wanting to listen? Or they've got some things that they're trying to, some decision points that they've got to work through, and just wanting an ear to listen to. So you can actually invite them to either share or just listen.
Hopefully that's a start to this person's problem as well, and a new way to frame it, hopefully. And final question, can we have Dave's office contacts? So I don't know if you're open to more clients or something, or is there a website they can go to for your practice? Or
I usually don't pick up clients in the sort of like private field, just because I'm working more so with the insurers and things like that. So I know that our company does take private clients. It might not just be with me, but I'll send those details to you and maybe get them to pass on if appropriate. But we have offices all across, you know, Western Sydney. So we've got Penrith, Parramatta, all the way up to the Central Coast and in Sydney. But look, I often find that, you know, sometimes if you have a family physician, and it's not to deflect the people away by no means, but certainly if you've got a family physician and they're dealing with a particular concern, they often can refer you to the right person. And sometimes even to a Christian psychologist as well, can be helpful, because it's part of our identity as well. So yeah, I'll give those details to you and pass them on.
Yeah, and I might grab contacts of Christian psychologists if you know of any good ones.
Sure.
Well, thanks, everyone. Actually, everyone stuck around for the extra Q&A, so that's great. Hopefully we're speaking to an issue that's really touching people. I guess what I'd like to say to wrap up is I hope that we've normalized or begun to normalize the idea of anxiety and depression in the Christian life, and all sorts of negative emotions in the Christian life. But to also paint that in the bigger framework, that we follow a savior who really understands those things and who is himself very gentle and lowly and humble. So understanding that we can get through this time in this world, which is hard because we have a good savior, but that our ultimate trajectory is towards a new creation and a new world that's absent of these things, but that we're face-to-face with our God. Dave, are there any last sort of thoughts that you want to leave for people?
Yeah, I guess I was just thinking about it when that song came up, because it was, I've never heard of that song, and I was like, oh, I'm going to take a screenshot so I can listen to it later. But we really are, I guess, as Christians, imitators of God. And for a lot of us, we'll often be quite down on ourselves for not being perfect. And so it's a process. You know, the process of maturity in Christian faith is a maturation. Like we get there in time. There's no shortcuts. And so if there was one thing that I think is the most practical thing, is your prayer life. I think nothing speaks more strongly than having a dialogue with someone like God. And not just sharing the sort of like easy times, but certainly the real time. So in that song actually was Help My Unbelief. And literally that was the phrase I had with God last week when I was wrestling with my own sort of concerns, like, God, you're good, but I'm doubting, just help my unbelief. And that was the phrase that I had. So I'd encourage people to not just read their Bibles and pray, but know the convictions that kind of make you who you are, what your identity is, and use them in your prayer. And I'll give you one example. My mom used to say to me, literally say to God, are you not? And then list everything you believe about him. So in my prayer would be like, are you not the God who lifts my head when I'm down? Are you not the God who knows the temptations I go through? Are you not the God? And literally just expressing it to God. It's much better than a psychologist, but you've got, you know, in psychology we'd call these positive affirmations, but in faith we would say these are our convictions. So I hope that blesses you to just, you know, realize how important our faith is in terms of how we deal with, you know, our day to day.
Thanks so much for your time, Dave. I'll hand it back to Nelly to close us off.
Thanks, everyone.